This is The Takeaway for Thursday, March 16th, 2017.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, filling in for John Hockenberry, and we're very happy to have you with us today. Last night, just hours before President Trump's second try at a travel ban was set to go into effect, it, like the first, was blocked in federal court. A district court judge in Hawaii froze the ban last night, saying it was rife with religious discrimination. Hours later, a second court, this one in Maryland, also blocked parts of that travel ban. President Trump's reaction was swift. Here he is at a rally in Nashville, Tennessee.
We're going to take our case as far as it needs to go, including all the way up to the Supreme Court. And let me tell you something. I think we ought to go back to the first one and go all the way, which is what I wanted to do in the first place.
Big cheers for President Trump there in Nashville. Leon Fresco is former Deputy Assistant Attorney General at the Justice Department and head of the Office of Immigration Litigation under President Obama. He's here with me from Boston for his take on the latest. Leon, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you, Todd.
So this is the second round. What does this ruling say? The last time when the courts blocked the travel ban, they did it largely on due process grounds. Not so much this time. This time the court seems to have a problem with the content of the order itself.
Correct. The problem and the difference between the first order and the second order is that the first order included a lot of people who have enhanced due process rights, including people with green cards and people who had visas that allowed them to travel back and forth from the United States to these banned countries. This order is only relevant to people who are applying for a new visa for entry from the six excluded countries. And so the court wasn't going to be able to use those same due process grounds. And so what the court did here is it actually said that the order is not a facially legitimate and bona fide order because the order is one that is drafted for a discriminatory purpose. And in this case, it was for a religious discriminatory purpose. And so the question moving forward for the appellate courts is going to be, is that actually a doctrine that exists in immigration law with respect to people who have never set foot in the United States before? Because there is this hot, contentious debate that people with this kind of status actually don't have access to the courts to make these kinds of religious discrimination claims.
And you even had Judge Derek K. Watson, who was the district judge in Hawaii, who said in his ruling that the travel ban was issued with a purpose to disfavor a particular religion in spite of its stated religiously neutral purpose. Those are his words. And he's basically saying there they can call this national security, but this is meant to ban Muslims.
Right. I mean, the problem with this particular order is not necessarily the text or the justification given in this second executive order. In fact, it's quite likely if this order had been issued by a different president under different circumstances, it'd be quite likely to survive this kind of judicial scrutiny. But the problem is, how do you now divorce this order in the way it's written from the last 6 months of comments that have been given by the administration and by folks within the administration?
So let me stop you there, because we have some of those comments, and you've got this tension now between the order itself, like you say, and the context, the political context with which it was delivered. And the judge himself cited statements like this. Here's Stephen Miller. He's, of course, a senior White House political advisor. Listen to Stephen Miller on Fox News back on February 21st, because this statement is actually cited in the ruling.
Fundamentally, you're still going to have the same basic policy outcome for the country, but you're going to be responsive to a lot of very technical issues that were brought up by the court. But in terms of protecting the country, those basic policies are still going to be in effect.
So, Leon, there's Stephen Miller saying this is the same as the first order. We've just kind of tweaked it. And let me play you President Trump from last night in Nashville, because I think these words might wind up being important, too.
The best way to keep foreign terrorists, or as some people would say in certain instances, radical Islamic terrorists, from attacking our country is to stop them from entering our country in the first place.
So forget about the cheers. The fact that the president is there billing this policy as keeping radical Islamic out of the country, could this hurt him later? Do we know from what the court has said here that this might be a problem?
Well, in general, if you were to say what is the ideal litigating strategy you would want on behalf of the government, you wouldn't want public statements being made of any kind with regard to this case. And that's actually the Ninth Circuit issued a dissent from its original opinion on the travel ban yesterday. And the judges who actually agreed with President Trump's logic in the first travel ban order still said that these statements that were being made, both about the courts and about the case in general, were not helpful to the cause of the president in trying to defend this order. And so these statements don't help, in fact. And so the question is, will a court, whether it be the Supreme Court or either the Ninth Circuit or the Fourth Circuit doing the Maryland case, decide to divorce the statements from the record itself, from this second order, or will these statements continue to be so intertwined with these travel orders that they will never be able to get these travel orders off the ground?
Right. I mean, do we have any sense of how the appeals courts behave in cases like this? We've had one ruling, of course, from the Ninth Circuit, how they behave, sort of contrasting what they call the four corners of the order. Here's what the policy is versus all of these political statements from Stephen Miller, from the president himself, from Rudy Giuliani saying, yes, it's a travel, yes, it's a Muslim ban, but make it legal. Kind of thing.
Well, we're in completely unprecedented territory here. And this is why I think we're in, you know, we're in day 60 of the presidency. This was supposed to originally be a 90-day review period to decide to put in a better visa program that wouldn't require a ban. It would be my advice to this administration to get that new visa program up and running and stop with this litigation, only from the standpoint that the authority that the president is invoking here is serious. It's actually necessary in some cases, and to potentially put that authority at risk because of case law that's developing from a bad fact pattern with these statements, I think at this point is not doing anybody a good service here. I think the better move is to put in the new visa program.
Well, that's a fascinating wrinkle that all of the rulings against what the president is trying to do may actually damage his own undisputed authority to set immigration policy. And that's an angle I haven't heard before. Leon Fresco is former Deputy Assistant Attorney General in the Obama Justice Department. Leon, thanks again.
Thank you.
So the court slapped another injunction on President Trump's travel ban in Hawaii. Meanwhile, in Washington, the outline of the president's budget is out, and it has enough policy shockers that even Republicans in Congress have called it dead on arrival. It should be said that the budget is called America First, and that's a slogan that President Trump has adopted from 1930s isolationists, people like Charles Lindbergh, who wanted to keep the United States out of Nazi Germany's business. It's just a bit of historical continuity for you. But here are a few things we know. The president wants to boost military spending by $54 billion, and he wants to pay for it with huge cuts to domestic programs. And I mean deep. Nearly a third of the EPA's budget slashed, a third at the State Department. There's more than $4 billion for that border wall in there that Mexico was supposed to pay for. The list goes on. It's a first step, though, in a process that's guaranteed to be full of confrontations with Congress over the spring and summer. Joining me now is Sharon Parrott. She's senior fellow and senior counselor at the Center for Budget and Policy Priorities. Sharon, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
Well, this is kind of an annual ritual in Washington. Different presidential budgets fare differently on the Hill. None of them really makes it out alive. But here's one with some pretty in-your-face policies. I mentioned that $54 billion increase in defense spending, but it's paired with massive cuts to domestic programs at the EPA and other places. So if a presidential budget is about messaging and priorities, what's the message here?
Well, I think it's that a broad range of public services and investments in our productivity that we really depend on, that Americans across the country depend on, are just not important in this budget. In fact, one of the really interesting and I'd say troubling things about the budget is that it hits hard public services and programs that people who are struggling in the economy really need. And that's the very group of people that President Trump said he wanted to make a priority. So just to take a couple of examples to make this concrete, President Trump's budget says it's going to cut job training when that factory worker gets laid off and needs to switch to a different career but needs some new skills, it's our job training programs that help provide those new skills. And he's cutting job training. He's also cutting student aid for some of our lowest income college students and work study programs that help low and moderate income college students earn some money while they're going to college. College is a really important pathway to the middle class, and yet it's an area that he's saying is not important in this budget.
So now the process starts, and Congress is going to get a hold of this document and rewrite it. What do we know about Congress's current attitude and how a budget and how spending might look by the summertime?
Yeah, President Trump's budget really turns on its head what has been a bipartisan agreement or view for the last several years. And that view is that the sequestration cuts that were enacted in 2011 and that have been tamping down or constraining our investments both in defense and non-defense areas are just too deep. And that's why Congress, again, on a bipartisan basis, has passed several budget deals over the last several years to reduce those harmful cuts and allow more investment, again, equally in defense and non-defense areas. President Trump's budget is saying, we're going to eliminate those harmful sequestration cuts in defense, and we're going to double down on sequestration in non-defense areas. I think the good news is that lots of members of Congress of both parties have said that they are not on board with this approach. And that's really important because the discussion we need to be having is what are our defense and domestic needs, and how do we come together and reach another bipartisan budget agreement that allows us to have funding levels that really can meet the nation's needs.
And before we let you go, Sharon Parrott, I think we should talk about that wall. It's only $4 billion proposed here, but Democrats in Congress have already said if you try to pay for this wall in April when there's an upcoming spending fight, we might force a government shutdown.
President Trump has actually proposed in his releases today, not only to put money in 2018, but to put money in 2017 to start down the path of the wall. I think it's fair to say it will be a subject of robust discussion this spring, and then again in the summer when we're looking toward 2018 funding levels.
And I would alert people as early as next month, the wall could lead to a major confrontation between Republicans, Democrats, and the White House, but that's to come. Sharon Parrott, thanks.
Thank you.
Sharon Parrott is senior fellow and senior counselor at the Center for Budget and Policy Priorities. Welcome back. It's Todd Zwillick with you today, filling in for John Hockenberry. President Trump won in Iowa by nearly 150,000 votes in November. Barack Obama won Iowa twice, so that win was a big deal for Donald Trump. But that 150,000, the same number of Iowans gained health coverage through Medicaid under the Affordable Care Act, and more gained coverage on the private exchanges after the law passed. There is, of course, now a huge debate in Congress about how to repeal Obamacare and how to replace it. Iowa Senator Chuck Grassley is a key player in that fight. So we wanted to go to one clinic in Iowa that cares for underserved Iowans to find out how the law's been working and what repeal could mean there. Dr. Cecilia Norris is medical director at the Iowa City Free Medical and Dental Clinic. You know, the broad mission of the Affordable Care Act, speaking really broadly, was to get a lot more people covered, to make primary care more accessible and incentivize prevention with a bunch of insurance mandates and guaranteed coverage. Basically, get more people through the door earlier so they can be healthier. Have you seen that working? How has it been working at your clinic over the last few years?
What I can tell you is at our clinic, we only see people who do not have insurance or are significantly underinsured. And before the Affordable Care Act, I was seeing many patients with chronic medical conditions who could not get the treatment that they needed in order to prevent complications. So, for example, patients with diabetes whose diabetes is not controlled are at increased risk for renal disease, neuropathy, which is loss of feeling in their feet, foot ulcers that can get infected, patients with high blood pressure and increased risk for heart disease and stroke. And these patients were not getting the care that they needed and developing complications. I have heard stories once patients get insurance, we do not see them at the clinic anymore. So I don't have the known follow-up, but I have heard back from patients who have been very thankful that with their insurance, they were able to get those complications treated.
So Dr. Norris, let's talk about Medicaid, because we're talking about the different kinds of insurance and underinsurance. Iowa is a state that took the Medicaid expansion. It expanded its Medicaid population. That is likely to go away under some form of Republican-led repeal, whatever that winds up being. If Medicaid were significantly pared back in your neighborhood, what would that mean?
That would mean a significant increase in the number of patients coming back to our clinic needing our services again, because the majority of our patients who were able to obtain insurance were able to do so under the expanded Medicaid provisions.
So you're in a small city, yes, but there are a lot of rural residents around you, and rural hospitals are one of the parts of the medical patchwork in this country that have been raising an alarm here in Washington about what could happen to them if the ACA goes away. What have you heard from your colleagues at the rural hospitals, where I assume you refer a lot of patients and where you take patients from?
They are extremely concerned about what is going to happen if the Affordable Care Act is repealed and the current plan is put into place. One of the big concerns, obviously, is when patients do not have insurance, the hospitals wind up eating that cost. With the significant decrease in the number of people without insurance, hospitals have been able to get reimbursed for the services they provide. And then in addition, there are some special reimbursements for rural hospitals for medications, and all of those will go away. So my colleagues are very concerned that we will lose many rural hospitals, which are vital to patients' health as well as the health of the community.
Well, Dr. Norris, I'm curious about your patients and what they say to you. You're a family physician yourself, right?
Yes.
Are your patients connected to this debate that goes on? I mean, we talk about policy reimbursement rates. I don't assume they care much about that, but they do care about their coverage, and they certainly care about their health care. So when you're sitting there with a patient, what kinds of concerns about all this have you heard from them?
The main thing that I have heard is the cost of the premiums under the Affordable Care Act being too much for them to afford previously for patients who might qualify for some of the subsidies. And that is the reason that they did not go ahead and get the insurance. However, in talking to them, I don't think that they all completely understand that those premiums are subsidized. They'd be lower than what they would pay if they were paying for the entire cost of the policy. Since the election, I have heard of a lot more fear of patients who have been considering getting insurance or waiting for the enrollment process to apply for the subsidies on the marketplace.
All right. Well, as Congress debates repealing and replacing Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, clinics all over the country are watching and waiting to see how it affects their ability to care for low-income patients. Dr. Cecilia Norris is one of them. She's medical director at the Iowa City Free Medical and Dental Clinic. Thank you so much, Dr. Norris.
Thank you.
It's hard to believe, but some people still don't get podcasts. But you can help change that with a click. That's right. Think of someone you care about. What podcast would they really love? Got it? Now do it. Hit the share button on the bottom left of your screen. If they don't know how to listen, offer to show them how. Tell us what you shared with the hashtag Tripod. That's T-R-Y pod. Thanks for spreading the word.
It's The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. And in China, they're wrapping up the annual National People's Congress this week. This is an annual gathering of 3,000 lawmakers in Beijing, where officials meet to discuss a whole bunch of national and foreign policy issues. This year, the big topics have been China's economic outlook and that country's relationship with Hong Kong and, of course, the United States. And the Communist Party still keeps the actual policy making under wraps. But the Congress is one time when average Chinese people get to have a glimpse into how their government, well, how it works. Keith Bradshaw is the Shanghai Bureau Chief for the New York Times, and he joins me now. Hi, Keith.
Hi, Todd.
Keith, this is a big event in China. Some people call it kind of a rubber stamp for a lot of behind-the-scenes maneuvering. What's the zeitgeist in China right now? What's leading the people's agenda here?
there's been a lot of hesitation about undertaking really serious economic reforms, like, for example, trying to bring greater efficiencies to the state-owned enterprises, trying to shift the economy maybe away from a model in which it's constantly borrowing more money to build ever more bridges and rail lines, and towards a model that relies more on consumer spending. So that's been the topic of the day. Now, that said, this Congress has not had the kind of sometimes enthusiastic discussion that you used to see a few years ago. The only really new, somewhat surprising mention that we heard was from one person who suggested that China was censoring the internet too heavily and that it was becoming a problem for researchers even to get mundane scientific papers from overseas because they were blocked from overseas access by the so-called Great Firewall of China. But that proposal was quickly squelched. It was not reported by domestic media in any significant way, and the Congress rolled onwards.
You know, at the same time, China's dealing with a new and somewhat unpredictable leader in President Trump. And he came out initially sort of rocking the boat on issues like Taiwan, but then he turned around and affirmed the One China policy, something that's very important to the Chinese government. I've been told by veteran diplomats and China watchers that a lot of Chinese officials feel like President Trump is manageable, a bombastic American businessman. You know, we've seen that before. That's no problem. We can handle him.
There has been something of that sentiment, and the way this administration has proceeded cautiously so far has raised the optimism among many Chinese officials that this is someone whom they can manage. That said, there are some tough questions coming down the line. One of the questions certainly will involve U.S. policy towards China and its very close ally, North Korea. Another question will be whether or not the United States imposes some kind of a so-called border adjustment tax.
And that border adjustment tax could be a huge part of a trillion-dollar tax reform attempt in this country. And that brings us to the key question of trade, because with the U.S. pulling out of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, one of the main criticisms here is that it puts China at the center of new trade alliances and just expands China's influence in its region. Are officials there seeing a big opportunity with the U.S. pulling back from the world when it comes to trade?
Some officials are, but somewhat to my surprise, as I've been talking to people in the past 2 weeks here in Beijing, they are very cautious. They're not ready, for example, to try to jump in to pick up the pieces of the Trans-Pacific Partnership. On the so-called Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership, which is their alternative, the RCEP, they have refrained from setting any new targets for when it's going to be done. Basically, they are, because of the worries about their own economy, very reluctant to open up their own market to other countries, even in exchange for more access to other Asian markets. So for now, they're in a rather cautious go-slow mode that not everybody had expected.
Keith Bradshaw, Shanghai Bureau Chief for the New York Times in Beijing with us. Keith, thank you.
Okay, thank you.
So as China debates its economic future, its trade negotiators have been in Chile this week. They're meeting up with delegations from other Pacific Rim countries, countries like Mexico, Canada, Australia, the list goes on. And leading the agenda is trade in a post-TPP world. President Donald Trump's official abandonment of the Trans-Pacific Partnership shortly after taking office has all of these other countries scrambling to reorient themselves for new agreements and a new game in the Pacific. Carlo Dade is Director of Trade and Investment Policy for the Canada West Foundation in Calgary, and he says there's still a lot of uncertainty in these other countries about how to cut deals and deal with a new United States.
Everyone around the Pacific, from us up here in Canada, down to Chile, over to Singapore and New Zealand, everyone is scrambling to try and figure out what the heck to do now that Donald Trump has upset the traditional trade apple cart around the Pacific. Countries such as Canada, we had hitched our Asia trade wagon to the Trans-Pacific Partnership. It was going to give us seven new agreements up from the one we currently have, and it was going to open Pacific markets. It was also going to update the North American trade agreement. Trump has really just upset all of our plans for opening the Pacific. You know, he's also thrown another wrench in by turning the U.S. from either an absentee. You know, everyone was expecting the U.S. to disappear from the global trade table. Instead, Donald Trump has taken the Dr. Jekyll we've all gotten used to and replaced it with a very scary Mr. Hyde. So everyone's suddenly trying to scramble from dealing with preparing for the absence of the U.S. to suddenly a new, much more nationalist, America first, aggressive U.S. At the table.
But at the same time, why isn't there a possibility for a TPP to go forward just without the United States? Is it that we're just too big and trade too much? It's not worth it without the U.S.?
No, it's technically possible. In and of itself, it's still a huge advantage. But politically, that's a difficult conversation to have with populations back home where the soundbite, we're doing X, Y, and Z to get access to the U.S. market is an easy sell. The more complex we're getting a trade bloc with one set of rules, we'll have advantages over countries like the U.S. that aren't there, is a much tougher sell.
How does a country like New Zealand or Japan or China, for that matter, view the prospect of new bilateral trade negotiations with the United States if they can't put their own form of TPP together?
So the thought of going from negotiations that will always be tough to something that is win-win for the U.S., but not win for anyone else. So the idea that you're going to negotiations where you would give something to get something and everyone would give up to gain, having that replaced by a U.S. first, the U.S. only gains from negotiations, has got to have people around the globe scared. The idea of having an alternative to that, not walking into those negotiations with nothing else going for you, has got to make the situation worse.
At the end of the day, from where you sit in Calgary, which Donald Trump do you think will finally end up with when the U.S. trade policy settles into a position here?
Trade analysts, we've been so wrong for so much about so long with Trump, it seems almost impossible. But what's clear with what he's done with taking the U.S. out of the TPP is he's done real harm to U.S. workers. If we go ahead with the TPP without the U.S., then countries like Canada and Mexico have access to this huge mega group. If you're a U.S. company and you want to take advantage of all the benefits, selling cheaper, new rules to protect intellectual property, et cetera, if you want to take advantage of that, you have to move your production out of the U.S. into a TPP signatory. So as Trump takes measures that seem populist to please some of the populist element, he's really doing damage. But what Trump's doing is essentially putting money on the table and shoving it at us, putting jobs on the table and shoving them at other countries and saying, please take them.
Carlo Dade is Director of Trade and Investment Policy for the Canada West Foundation. Carlo, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
Welcome back. It's Todd Zwillick with you today, and we've been talking a bit about trade this hour, about China, about the United States and the Trans-Pacific Partnership. That's the policy, but what about the actual trade? I mean the ships. I mean the boxes.
Some of the more notable innovations in solving the logistical problems in Vietnam have been in the field of containerization. Here we see a sea-land ship which transports 500 containers, the size of the 35-foot semi-trailers which deliver them to the ship and onto which they are offloaded at the port in Vietnam.
That's footage there from 1967, the height of the Vietnam War. President Lyndon Johnson was boosting the American presence in Vietnam in more ways than one, as it turned out, but trade was actually part of it. Shipping containers were new back then, only on the scene for about a decade at the time. But container ships grew from there, and in the decades since, they've become the very basis of global trade. Those rectangular boxes that you see everywhere, you know, they don't look like much, but today, 90% of all global trade rides in them at some point. There's a new 8-part podcast called Containers, and it's all about the transformation we owe to those big steel crates, looking out from the port of Oakland in California. Alexis Madrigal is editor-at-large at Fusion, and he's the creator of Containers. And he says those metal boxes that we hardly interact with at all are the embodiment of modern capitalism, and they've changed everything from how we trade to where we live.
Before, essentially, the ship itself, like the hull, that was the container. So whatever you were going to put into it, these guys called longshoremen, would have had to go in and kind of strap it all up and kind of, you know, when you're like doing a U-Haul trip and you've got to like brace everything. That's what they had to do for transoceanic voyages. And they liked their job. It was fun. It was challenging. It was interesting. And they had a very powerful union, actually two of them. In the East Coast, it was the ILA, and out here in the West, it was the ILWU. And when the container came in, it required about a tenth of the work. And it caused massive, massive disruption. And they developed a lot of their own thinking about it. This is Herb Mills, just to tee it up. He's kind of a worker philosopher. He's a political science PhD, and he was also a member of ILWU Local 10.
The containerization is the technological underpinning of the global economy. That and rapid communication is why jobs have flowed out of the United States. So the container has been the physical means of exploiting cheap labor throughout the world.
You know, Alexis, every time I drive outside of New York or near the port of Long Beach, for that matter, when I'm in California, you see these gigantic cranes. And every time I see them, I think they could never make On the Waterfront, that film with longshoremen. They could never make that now. And it's because of those giant cranes. They've taken all that away.
That's right. I mean, it was a form of automation, in fact. And when those cranes first started to be built here in Alameda, in the Bay Area, and elsewhere, I mean, they called them automated cranes. And what they essentially did was reshape everything about the waterfront. In New York, over the course of 12 years, the longshoremen lost 90% of their hours. The other thing that it did to cities was that it took manufacturing centers, which were port cities, right? They were located along the water, Brooklyn, Manhattan, San Francisco, London. These were actually factory towns, and people tend to forget that. And what happened with containerization is that the factories didn't have to be in the cities anymore. They could move out to the suburbs. The system of containerization would feed them their components, and they could feed them back to a different port. Usually, say, Newark is outside of New York. Long Beach and the whole San Pedro Bay outside of Los Angeles and Oakland across the bay from San Francisco here, the entire geography of cities changed. Like sometimes I think about, you know, the Brooklyn aesthetic, you know, these like empty warehouses. Like, well, why are the warehouses empty? Containerization. Like, that's it. The entire creation of that kind of New York, the one that we know now, is dependent on those areas emptying out because their economic base was eroded by containerization. I should say that containerization allowed for a tremendous explosion in global trade. And it's a big reason why stuff that used to cost like a day's labor now costs like $4 a Target. Anytime you hear the phrase global trade, you should replace it with like how Target works, because people like Target. And I think it shows the way that, you know, it's easy in the abstract to say these labor systems are bad or this overall system of economic activity is bad. But also we want to go to Target.
And as one subculture disappears, the subculture of the longshoreman, which is all but gone, another one has sprung up. There are thousands, tens of thousands of people now who spend their lives on floating cities, essentially.
Yeah, I mean, the global economic order like truly depends on a lot of usually Filipino sailors deciding that they're going to spend up to, you know, 70% of their time, 80% of their time away from their families, running containers back and forth across the ocean. I mean, I think the thing that I didn't think about before I started talking with these sailors, when you get into port, it's not like the old days. You know, you don't get to, you know, spend 4 days carousing. You're in and out in a day because containers can be loaded and unloaded so quickly. A sailor said, you know, I've been all around the world and it all looks like my engine room. You know, they never really get off the ships for more than 24 hours, you know.
Meanwhile, there are major environmental concerns with this form of trade. I mean, there are entire areas of federal regulation at the EPA aimed just at tractor-trailer trucks that sit and idle in ports for hours. This is a huge, major source of air pollution in American ports.
It is. It is. The local environmental repercussions of global trade can be quite bad. You know, rates of asthma in particular and other associated cardiopulmonary problems in West Oakland, which is the largely black area that's directly adjacent to the port, have been very, very high. Some incredible work has been done to reduce that. I mean, there are policy solutions for these things. The state of California has passed laws that require ships to actually burn a different kind of fuel and when they come to the dock to plug into electrical power called shore power.
So we've seen all these ways that containerization has affected the culture, from employment to cities to the suburbs to pollution. Containerization even of the culture. You know, I can name three different hotspots around D.C. where I live where the entire motif is containers. How did that happen?
You know, I think that most people associated with the industry think it's kind of hilarious. Like, the box for them is as much the abstraction as it is the actual thing. What containerization allows you to do and what the box allows you to do is you just don't have to think about what's in there, right? It's almost like the internet. There's this thing called the internet protocol, right, which allows individual packets to be sort of transferred around the internet. It doesn't matter what's inside of them, right? And that allows for this explosion of communication. And that is basically what happened on the container side, that like once you don't have to think about the goods inside the box, inside the packet, it's much easier to design the systems that flow goods around the world.
Alexis Madrigal hosts the podcast called Containers, all about our changing economy, our changing labor landscape, and world trade from the perspective of those big steel rectangular containers. Alexis Madrigal, editor-at-large at Fusion, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Well, President Trump made a special trip to honor President Andrew Jackson yesterday. And coming up next, how do you think we should remember some of our country's most difficult history?
Hello, this is Emma from Chicago. I think President Jackson was disgraceful. The Indian Removal Act and the resulting Trail of Tears is one of the darkest periods in American history. Although I do believe that these events would have occurred even with someone else in office, which is probably an even more disturbing fact.
And we got this from Portland, Oregon. We should remember our history, but don't glorify it. This is our uncomfortable truth. To make our omelet, we had to crack some eggs. Our job is to now make sure that we all get a piece of it. 8778-MY-TAKE is our number. You can always join the conversation on the Takeaways Facebook page. More on President Trump and President Jackson coming up.
The Takeaway is supported by Enterprise Florida, working to promote Florida as a premier business destination for companies interested in relocation or expansion. More information at floridathefutureishere.com. And Squarespace, a website building platform that helps anyone register a domain and create their own website. More at squarespace.com. Squarespace, make your next move.
Welcome back to The Takeaway. It's Todd Zwillick with you today, filling in for John Hockenberry. And President Trump made a very special visit to the estate and gravesite of President Andrew Jackson on Wednesday in Nashville, Tennessee. He laid a wreath and gave a military salute to pay tribute to the former president in honor of his 250th birthday.
And on this, his 250th birthday, Andrew Jackson's Magnolia is a sight to behold. I looked at it, actually, this morning. Really beautiful.
That magnolia sits outside the Oval Office. That's how President Trump gets to see it every morning. And his fondness for the former president is no secret. He had Jackson's portrait hung in the Oval Office, and he's criticized the removal of Andrew Jackson's image from the $20 bill. Trump's ascent to the presidency on this wave of populism, winning over working class voters and promising to drain the swamp, has drawn a lot of comparisons to Andrew Jackson. Some people have even called Trump supporters Jacksonian Republicans. But Jackson's popularity for him has eroded over time. His legacy as a pro-slavery president and his infamous policy of Indian removal that led to the Trail of Tears has aligned him with white nationalists. But his gravesite is welcome visits from more than one president. And we're going to talk about that with Barbara A. Perry. She's Presidential Studies Director at the Miller Center at the University of Virginia. And she joins me. Dr. Perry, it's great to have you.
Great to be here, Todd.
Well, other presidents, as I said, have visited Andrew Jackson and his mansion. It's not just Donald Trump. FDR visited, LBJ, Ronald Reagan, and others. What are politicians saying? What are they trying to get out of connecting themselves with Andrew Jackson's legacy when they do these visits? What's the subtext here?
The subtext is, I think, for all of these presidents, I am one of you. I am a man of the people. And that's exactly what we continue to remember Andrew Jackson for, and in a good way. You've pointed out, of course, why his star is dimming in the pantheon of presidents and that he's dropping in the polls of historians who rate presidents. But I think for Republicans and Democrats alike, who all want to be connected to the people, he's the go-to person because he founded Jacksonian democracy, which enlarged the electorate and brought in the common man.
And while that star is dimming, though, is there a subtext also? You know, President Trump's main slogan, make America great again. It seems to me he's saying, I don't care if his star is dimming. That just proves my point that we have to go back to the way America was and make it great again.
I think you're absolutely right, Todd, on that. And I made a note to myself about this morning in our conversation that I think that Andrew Jackson's star is dimming and he's dropping in the polls for the very reasons that Trump won. And that is Trump's claims against PC are the very things that have caused Jackson's star to dim and his poll ratings to drop. And I think that Trump wears that as a badge of honor.
Well, let's listen to President Trump talking about President Jackson as he was honoring him yesterday.
From poverty and obscurity, Jackson rose to glory and greatness, first as a military leader and then as the seventh president of the United States. He did it with courage, with grit, and with patriotic heart. And by the way, he was one of our great presidents.
So President Trump isn't comparing himself directly, I don't think, to Andrew Jackson. I mean, he doesn't have a humble beginning story himself. But it seems like he's trying to invoke an idea of America here for his voters, a bootstrap story, a rise from obscurity to greatness.
Absolutely. And it's back to the populist message. Again, man of the people, someone who rises up. And remember, even though we know the facts are that Trump didn't come from nothing, he did tell that narrative that he was a self-made man, if we recall in the campaign. So I think he makes the link to Jackson in that way. But I think to your point and the point that the president raised validly yesterday in Nashville at the Hermitage, at the gravesite of Andrew Jackson, was that Jackson was a patriot. He was a national. He put America first, if you will, and he put the Union first at a time when we saw the beginnings of what would split us apart and cause the Civil War with the nullification crisis, the tariff crisis, John C. Calhoun talking about South Carolina seceding from the Union.
Well, let's compare some of the histories from Jackson's time in the 30s in the minute or two that we have left, because the country is divided now. Yes, in a similar way, maybe to what it was then, but seemingly not as divided, right, as it was when Jackson was president in the 1930s and the country was headed towards civil war. Is it a mistake to compare Jackson's time to the current divisions in American society and say that Trump and Jackson are presiding over similar Americas?
I think it's always a fraught exercise to compare time periods that are separated by centuries and decades. But I think that we do see this division that Jackson himself worried about. And the tariff crisis itself and the bank crisis was sectional. And since we see ourselves now divided into sectionalism, into regions of the country that we saw in 2016 in the election and that helped to make Trump president through the Electoral College, I think that in that sense there is a parallel to draw, and the lessons of history are important to learn.
Some of the lessons of history, of course, play right into what we've already talked about, which is Jackson's star sort of on the descent in the eyes of history. He's on the $20 bill. He was, of course, celebrated. That's on the downswing now. There's a counter narrative to what Donald Trump is broadcasting with Make America Great Again, and a lot of it has to do with how we now view Jackson.
Absolutely. You're absolutely right that, again, because of his slaveholding, which we have to admit that our greatest presidents, including George Washington and the founding fathers, were, of course, slave owners. Most of them were from the South. But we should also remember that in the case of Jackson, more time had marched on. He never saw slavery as a moral issue. This is one of the issues, I think, to this day in the Black Lives Matter campaign, which is why progressives have moved away from Jackson. I think why Trump and his supporters are embracing him.
And also his famous, infamous, if I have to say it, policy of Indian removal. It led to the Trail of Tears. Underreported in history classes, at least in my history classes, but one of the dark stains on American development.
Absolutely. A blot on the American record, to be sure, a moral blot. Interestingly enough, the only law that the only major law that passed in the 8 years of Jackson, because he had actually vetoed 12 pieces of legislation coming out of Congress. He was often at odds with them, but the one piece of major legislation that he signed into law was the Indian Removal Act.
Well, President Trump, as many other presidents have, makes a visit to the mansion of Andrew Jackson to try to claim some of that legacy of the common man and American populism, even as American history and American culture has moved on in many ways. Dr. Barbara A. Perry, President, Presidential Studies Director at the Miller Center at the University of Virginia. Thank you so much.
Pleasure to be with you, Todd.
Hello, this is Kathy Hornick in Harrisonburg, Virginia. I think we should remember our history realistically. Our founding fathers were the best and the worst, and that's at the same time. And we can't pretend the ugly parts didn't happen, but we can be proud of the progress we have made and just keep pushing forward.
Well, President Trump's visit to Andrew Jackson's tomb and mansion has us asking you how we should remember the dark chapters of American history, and we've got lots and lots of context from you throughout this hour. 877-8-MY-TAKE is always the number to call. You can head to our Facebook page. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Todd Zwillick, in for John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Curious.com, committed to helping people build their CQ or Curious quotient through the game of lifelong learning. Curious, where people can learn something new every day at curious.com/PRI. Staples, offering copy and print solutions for business materials printed in-store or ordered online, including business cards, presentations, large banners, and posters. More at Staples and Staples.com. Staples, make more happen.
PRI, Public Radio International.